I went shopping for some hope to plant in the garden, only to find that my favorite garden shop was closed for being non-essential. And so I ask, should gardening be certified essential?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1229th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Christchurch who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, when the coronavirus came into our world, we were told by the best virus experts in the land that millions of people could die right here in the USA. And so we dutifully panicked and locked ourselves away in social isolation. Well, it didn't take long for this splendid isolation to wear on a lot of people, forcing many of us to turn to their gardens for relief. I was one of them. But when I went looking for some hope to plant in my favorite local garden shop, I found that its gates had been locked because the garden shop was certified as being non-essential. Those locked gates reminded me of a Food Chain Radio episode I hosted some time ago featuring the horticulture program at California's Soledad State Prison. As I walked the yard with the program's instructor, I could easily identify two types of prisoners: those who worked with the prison's plants and grounds, and those who did not. The prisoners who did not work with plants were the ones whose looks frightened me. And so the close sign on my favorite garden shop got me to wondering why something so elemental as gardening would be classified by the authorities as being non-essential. The mere act of gardening provides one with sunshine and fresh air, grounding to the earth, and above all, hope that what one does will bring a future. What better way to survive the great 2020 Made in China coronavirus pandemic panic than to garden? And so I ask, should gardening be certified essential? Here to help us find an answer, we have Missy Gable, who is the statewide director of the University of California's Master Garden Program. Welcome to the Food Chain, Missy.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
Well, it's almost like you're the mistress of the Master Garden Program. Mistress Missy of the Master Garden Program. Something
well,
like
that's
that.
Generous. I will say it's just a real pleasure to work with such a great team of people in the Master Gardener Program and do really critical work, especially right now.
Now, is this a program that's unique to California, or is it something that people do everywhere, Master Garden programs?
The Master Gardener Program is actually an international program.
And
people can look up whether or not they have a Master Gardener Program in their state, if they're in the U.S., or their country, by going to mastergardener.extension.org.
So there's master gardeners everywhere. That's good to know.
What is a
master gardener?
That's a great question. Extension Master Gardener volunteers are members of the community. They may or may not have a previous background in horticulture formally. All of them have a real passion for supporting their local communities, and most of them have an interest in gardening. So Extension Master Gardener volunteers are, again, members of our community who elect to essentially partner with their local academic institution to get training on how to do gardening sustainably, all of the best practices using research-based information. Once our volunteers are trained, they go out into the public and they teach the public how to be sustainable stewards of our environment when they're working in their home landscape.
Wow, that's quite a service. I did not even know it existed. I knew that there was such a thing as master gardeners, but I kind of thought they were like experts at master gardening their own gardens or something. I didn't know what they were. But this service is available to the rest of us then.
It is. There are, I believe, about 90,000 volunteers in the United States alone. And most of the states have some sort of hotline that people can call into or maybe send in an email. And then our volunteers often host classes and programs through farmers markets, local libraries, and other community organizations.
Okay, well, good. I don't suppose I could get them to weed my garden.
We focus on education, so we will teach people how to identify what a weed is and what a weed isn't.
There you go. Good to go. Well, you know, when we were discussing doing the show, you talked about being hard-pressed because you now have a brand new full-time job, which is homeschooling your children. And I got to wondering about you as the mistress of Master Gardening. How do you work with your children in gardening? How old are they?
Oh, my kids are, both of them, we are newly 4 and newly 6.
Okay.
And, gardening is so important. Wherever people live, whether they're in an urban setting or a rural setting, getting our kids outdoors so that they're engaging with the natural environment is so important to their development and understanding of the world and kind of the process by which they will enter the world to be a steward of our environment.
Would you say that it's essential?
Gardening?
Yes.
Absolutely. Whether you're talking about kids or adults, there are some real, incredible, impactful benefits that we get from gardening. If we talk about the physical benefits, it's things like fine motor skills when you're pruning. It's joint health when you're moving your body in different ways to get to the plants in your landscape and move around mulch, plants, whatever it is that you're working with in the garden. There are a ton of physical benefits. And then when we look at the mental benefits, I think this is a space that I would love to see people understand and explore more. When we are in an outdoor setting, research has shown that incredible things happen to our body. Our muscle tension goes down, heart rate goes down, blood pressure goes down. Serotonin, which is our happy hormone, goes up, whereas noradrenaline, that's that fight or flight response, that hormone goes down. These benefits really translate to an overall feeling of wellness. And when surveyed, people find incredible mental benefits to being in these outdoor spaces and having these kind of physical changes in their bodies that happen just from a closer connection to nature.
You know, when I had the opportunity to visit the Soledad State Prison and feature their horticulture program on the Food Chain radio program, I got to spend time on the yard with the instructor. And there was just clearly two kinds of people that were inmates in the prison. One group worked out on the cement, and they did exercises and built up their muscle strength. And the other group worked with the plants, and you could just see the difference in their countenance. You know, one group looked ferocious and was ready to rumble at the slightest provocation, and the other group was at peace with the world and with their situation, or so it seemed to me, and at least that was the way they presented themselves to me as well. And you could just, it was such a stark contrast. So what you say about all of those healthy mental and physical benefits was manifest right there in front of me. But going back to your kids, how do you work your kids into the garden? What is your secret?
Oh, well, there's so many different ways to get your kids out into the garden to have a fun and exciting activity. Kids have wildly creative imaginations. And so what we've done recently with this COVID pandemic is spend a lot of time just hunting for new and exciting things, whether that's kind of a nature treasure hunt as we're out and about on a walk, or spending time in our backyard identifying new pets, or at least that's what my kids think they are. So we've found praying mantis egg sacs. We've found a number of sneaky lizards.
Wait a minute. Back up for a minute, because that was very interesting. Who told them that they were pets? Did they come up with that themselves, or did you give that to them?
You know, it's interesting. I think that concept really, they manifested that concept after a conversation with me about the fact that we are not the only things that live in and around our house. And to them, in with their creative little brains, that manifests as this idea of having pets, which is something that both of them are so interested in. And so we've really adopted. We've got a pair of, and I quote unquote, sneaky lizards. That's how we refer to them. We have a pair of sneaky lizards living underneath our basketball hoop. And we found a bird's nest. And we've been able to identify the life cycle of ladybug beetles, which has been really fun because they have such distinct phases in their life cycle. We've been able to talk about that and really experience it in a significant way. And both kids have been very excited to try their hand at planting. And this has translated to them, actually, I think yesterday it was, one of them ate an entire apple down to the core just to get to the seeds so that she could then plant 6 apple seeds in the backyard. They're not going to come up because there's no irrigation where she planted them. But we're working on other creative solutions to making sure she sees the fruits of her labor in the mm-hmm. future.
But therein lies a lesson for her as well about
Absolutely.
Where you plant your seeds.
This is very true. You know, both plants and children need need tending, or they're likely to get out of hand.
You know, and that's one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, but was kind of embarrassing to ask. Do you recognize the similarities of working with plants and children?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Like I said, both, you know, in order to keep everyone from getting out of hand. You know, whether it's the kids or the plants, we do a lot of tending in our landscape, in the landscape of our family, in the landscape of our gardens. The only difference I see really, or maybe not the only difference, but a key difference is that if one of your plants gets out of hand, you can just replace it. whereas with the kids, we do a lot more of that hands-on tending because they're with us and we're going to figure out how to grow up properly.
Mm-hmm. And working with them in the garden is a great place to start because that's you could teach them all about the birds and the bees, right?
Exactly. Personally, I live in a very urban setting. I'm right by Sacramento, California. And it's important to me that my kids have, to the extent that it's possible, that they have a connection to nature. My family is a youth. I grew up in rural settings. I have a family farm in the central part of the United States. And so having those experiences as a kid, that's translated to wanting to make sure that to the extent that it's possible, I give my kids kind of correlate experiences, but in this very urban setting.
And it's probably even more important in an urban setting to give the children that than in the country setting where they're going to get it one way or another anyway. Gosh, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're bringing gardening into our life during this time of the coronavirus pandemic panic and asking, should gardening be essential? In some places, they've closed our garden stores, and I'm just frosted with that action. I want to have a revolution to overturn the closing of our garden shops. And we're going to try that with Missy, who is Missy Gable, who is the director of the UC Master Gardener Program, and we will be right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, thank you very much. This is the Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson. Today we're talking about gardening with Missy Gable, who's the director of the UC Master Gardener Program, a program that is worldwide. Master gardeners, they will come into your life and help you learn how to garden and how to do it the right way. And there is a right way of gardening, is there not, Missy?
There is a right way of gardening, yes.
And what would that be?
Well, whether you're gardening for aesthetics with ornamental plants or you're growing produce that you're going to feed your family and or your community, it's really important to be a sustainable practitioner in your landscape. There are ways that you can work to conserve water, to reduce waste, to prevent material, green waste material from going into our landfills. These are really important and key steps in making sure that we're taking care of our environment as we are enjoying a recreational activity outside, like gardening.
Are not gardeners natural environmentalists when it gets right down to it?
You know, at heart, I truly believe that they are, yes. I think something important right now that we're seeing is that more and more people who maybe have not gardened in the past or recently are taking up gardening. And that's so important. I just applaud those people for that effort because it's critical to your mental and physical health, especially right now as we're stuck inside. We might not have access to our gym and we feel isolated. So I think it's really important. But as more new gardeners come into our gardening community, it's our responsibility to make sure that they understand how to be productive and how to do it in a way that is environmentally conscious.
Well, let's start. Let's begin with a garden space. Let's say we have a nice front yard and a nice backyard. How do we know which direction to take this space? Where do we start?
Ooh, well, you know, people can be both aesthetic gardeners. You can have a beautiful aesthetic landscape with flowers for pollinators. You can also have an edible garden, and your edible garden can be in and of itself extremely aesthetic. We typically talk about the two a little bit differently, how you manage your ornamental landscape versus your edible landscape. Both are beautiful, both are productive, and have really great environmental services that they contribute, either by attracting pollinators and or by producing fruits and vegetables that you can consume.
Well, one of my gardens in the front is an edible, kind of focused on fruit trees and various tree crops. And in the backyard, it's kind of an ornamental place where we grow those things that attract pollinators. I love sitting in the backyard at the end of the day and listening to the buzz of hummingbirds and bees and butterflies. And it's a different kind of sustaining than the fruit I get out from the front yard. But both are very sustaining in themselves and enjoyable because of that. But when I looked at starting my gardens, I thought, you know, the lay of the land kind of determines what to do where when it gets right down to it. The front yard was suitable for fruit trees and the backyard for ornamentals. So it kind of decided itself.
Absolutely. If you're going to be an edible gardener, you're going to want to identify a space in your landscape that gets at least 6 to 8 hours of direct sunlight.
Ah, the sun. You know, I keep thinking that the sunshine has a lot to do with the basic reason why California is experiencing much less COVID-19 trouble than New York. I might be wrong, but I don't think so. I think having that sun is just a big help, and we've been doing a lot of it here. So you talked about there being a difference then between how you go about approaching an edible and an ornamental garden.
Absolutely. I personally, my landscape situation is flipped from yours. I have an ornamental front and an edible backyard. I get more sunlight in the back of my home. And now what's important, I have a little family of four. When it comes to edible landscaping or edible gardening, I think there are some really important considerations that people should make. First and foremost is placement. You know, if you put your edible plants in full shade, I've got a trellis of blackberries, and if that was in full shade, I would not have a productive blackberry harvest. So you want to make sure that you're placing your edible plants in a space that gets ample sunlight for the growth and development of that produce. I think it's also really important to consider how many people you're feeding and what they like to eat. I think this is oftentimes kind of a hurdle that some of us have to get over. If your family doesn't eat Brussels sprouts, maybe you want to try a plant or a different plant in the cabbage family. See if you can get them eating or expanding their palate.
A quick aside, Missy, with a couple young children, is it hard to find something in the brassica family for them to eat?
That's a really good question. I think a staple for kids is to start with broccoli.
Okay. That's the least offensive, right?
That seems to be the least offensive, at least in my household.
Okay. But if you were to start with Brussels sprouts, it would probably be the toughest job of all. So that's a good consideration,
Yeah, plant what people are going to eat. My family is really big on berries. So we have a blackberry trellis. We have a couple of thornless raspberry bushes. We've got a blueberry, and then we've got some strawberries as well. So we really have kind of focused on those crops that the kids are excited to watch grow and develop, that they can harvest on their own without pruning equipment and enjoy.
So the more enjoyment they get out of it, the easier it is to invest your time into growing it as well.
Absolutely. I used to do a lot of food preservation, and that was just a wonderful practice that I miss and look forward to doing again someday. It doesn't fit well right now in my life because having hot pots on a stovetop over a long period of time just often has led to kitchen nightmares.
Right. That's a great point as well, because it's not only your landscape that determines what you should grow, it's you and your time and your inclinations and everything else about you as well, because you're the one that's going to have to be out there doing this gardening. So you may as well find those things you like to eat and that please you.
Yes, it's what you have time to pick and process. Otherwise, you're putting your own resources, water, time, effort, into the growth and development of plants that then you are not receiving a benefit from in terms of being able to consume them and get the nutrition and the value from those plants. You know, my family focusing on berries has allowed us to actually grow plants that we don't get to enjoy for a very long period of time. We never actually get to bring the harvest indoors. Our blackberries, our raspberries, blueberries, they are all stripped by the kids while they are out just generally enjoying the backyard and or foraging. I call it forage and play.
Sure.
And we never really get to bring that in and process it, which works for me because we don't have a ton of time.
There you go. There's another thing about that, though, that's very fascinating, too. There's something very, very delicious about a vine-ripened, sun-warmed strawberry. It's just bursting with flavor.
This is so true. I think my favorite thing is warm cherry tomatoes, hot off the vine.
So there you go. But let's talk about starting plants. How do you, have children. One thing parents often love to do is, get out a paper towel and put some seeds on it and wipe and wet it and then cover it up and wait for the seeds to sprout. And there the kids have a lesson. Do you do that, or do you take the shortcut and go get some starts from the
I do a little bit of both. I think the lesson in starting seeds is such an important one. I also recognize developmentally where my kids are. And my youngest, he works hard to try to be gentle, but we are still in the learning process. So actually, a lot of the seeds that we started were smashed, pulverized, and or otherwise destroyed in the process of transplanting. And so while we did start some seeds for the educational value, for the fun, it was a great activity. I also managed to buy some transplants actually from a local community college. Their horticulture department was able to continue with their plant sale virtually. And so I picked up my plant starts from them this year.
Good. And what do you? How do you go about buying a transplant? What do you look for? What do you know? Which? How do you know which one to buy?
Ooh, well.
The question of the millennium's right.
That is the question of the millennium. I have a bit of a plant problem. When I see plants, I like to bring plants home. So for me, I always start with a plan. That also helps me to kind of focus my efforts to keep from growing, you know, more tomatoes than I can actually handle. Or I have a basil problem. Right now I'm growing 3 varieties, but it left to my own devices. If no one was checking me, I would be growing every variety available. So having a plan really has helped me focus on what I'm looking for when I am able to purchase transplants. And then really just looking for plants that look healthy, are not spindly or kind of weak-stemmed, is what I'm going for. I want to have a nice green color if the plant's supposed to be green, and a relatively strong stem. Now, that doesn't always apply when it comes to tomatoes. Tomato starts are planted. They can be kind of dug into your soil. There's great visuals and videos that people can look up about how to plant tomato transplants. But sometimes I can get away with pretty spindly tomato transplants just by digging them deeper into my soil.
Amen. And what about the genetics? Because it really, it's all in the seed and in the genetics of the seeds as to what the finished product will be. And that's what's really hard to know because there are so many varieties of everything. Do you have a way of getting a fix on, you know, what type of what variety of tomato to plant?
Yes, you know what? It's really, it's important to me that I plant plants that have some disease resistance. And that's because my garden, while I tend it and I manage it, I'm going to own that if a disease came through my tomatoes and we didn't have some, you know, black spot resistance, it would wipe them out because I'm likely to miss it. It's just the reality of my life right now. So I do spend some time looking up tomato varieties. I think it's also really important to know if you're kind of a seasoned gardener, you've established the type of taste that you want. Do you want juicy? Do you want acidic when it comes to something like a tomato? Mm-hmm. So I spend a little time looking at flavor profiles and then also disease resistance. And truly, this sounds overwhelming, I'm sure, to new gardeners. But you can reach out to your local Extension Master Gardener program and ask what resources that they have that could be shared with you.
This is a good place to begin basic research. What kind of plant do I want? What is my taste? What do I value? And there are means to find that, and a good place to start would be your local Master Garden program, because they have volunteers that probably will not weed your garden, but might tell you the point, the direction for some good varieties. So soil. We put them in the soil, right?
Yes. Yeah, soil health is huge. And actually, if we go back to our previous conversation about kids, I think this is a really, really great way to get kids interacting in your garden is actually check out your soil, see what's living in it. We know that the top couple inches of your soil profile is a really dynamic kind of micro.
A billion, trillion, zillion bugs are in there.
Exactly. And sometimes you can find mycorrhizae, you can find that white filamentous fungus, and it's just really an incredible place to kind of get your hands in and feel the different textures. Get dirty. I think we have to teach our youth today that it's okay to get your hands dirty. It's okay to touch bugs. Not all bugs are bad bugs. With my family, we spent a lot of time getting our hands in the soil. And folks can get to know their soil when they're figuring out where and how to place their edible garden, if that's what they're going to be doing in their landscape. You know, if you have a heavy clay soil that you can't amend, I would throw a planter box on top of that and fill that with an appropriate soil mixture in order to successfully grow fruits and vegetables.
And I have one of the sponsors of the food chain has a garden box that you can plant a garden anywhere. You can roll the garden box right up to it and put some soil in it, and away you go. A lot of people are going this direction, those who especially who live in condominiums or places with small gardens, can have a garden without much trouble at all. Have a box and throw some soil in it, and away you go. I have to ask, do your kids find angleworms or earthworms amusing when they find them in the soil?
Worms are pretty amusing, yes. We have done some experimenting with worms, trying to put them in the swimming pool, see if they can swim, that kind of thing.
that kind of thing.
It's a little kiddie pool, so we rescue them pretty quickly and put them back in the soil.
We're going to take a quick break right now, but when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about feeding plants. They being autotrophs and we being heterotrophs, it's a different way of feeding. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What with Missy Gable, who is the director, the statewide director of the UC Master Gardener Program, which is a program you can use to learn how to be a sustainable gardener. Right back.
So much to say. So much to say. Michael Olson. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we are back. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. And today we're going to talk a little bit about feeding plants because they eat too, just like we do, but they eat a little bit differently than we do because they are autotrophs, which means they are self-feeding, and we are heterotrophs, which means that we rely on others to provide our food for us. Is that a fair summation, Missy Gable?
That sounds pretty accurate to me.
And so when we say that plants are autotroph, that means that they take these simple elements from the environment and turn them into complex compounds that we, people, rely on for our food. So we have the responsibility then of providing those simple elements. And how do we go about doing that, Missy?
Well, you're right. Plants need both macronutrients and micronutrients in order to thrive. And when they are missing a key nutrient, they tend to show their symptoms by changing their color, maybe getting splotchy leaves or a little bit of burn on leaf edges. It really depends on what the nutrient deficit is, what the symptom that plant is going to show. And so plants get all of their nutrients from the soil, which is why understanding your soil is so important.
And from water. And from the air.
Absolutely. You can certainly add nutrients into your plant's diet when you're irrigating. Yes.
Now, how best to get these essential elements to our plants? What is the best thing? There seems to be two basic ways of doing it. One, we can provide the essential elements in their elemental form, like nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. We can synthesize those elements from the environment into fertilizers and feed them directly to the plant. Or the other way is to provide a soil that's rich in those essential elements and let the plant go find their own food for themselves. Which do you recommend?
You know, I really love getting to know your soil and understanding your soil before adding anything to it. Because, you know, I've been really fortunate in my own home landscape. We're on an alluvial plain that has a lovely, rich soil. We don't have a huge organic layer on our soil, but we have some, but it's very rich. And I have rarely provided supplemental nutrients for my plants because my soil is taking care of that for me. Now, that isn't the case with everyone, but it's still important to get to know your soil and what it is already providing so that you're not, you know, maybe you have a high level of nitrogen in your soil. In that situation, you would not want to add extra nitrogen because that can be problematic for your plants. So if you have just started an edible garden and you have a planter box, you filled that planter box with a mix, a soil mix that you purchased, that's probably a pretty well-balanced soil that's designed for you to be able to effectively grow your fruits and vegetables in that space. If you're planting directly in the ground, you can do a couple of different things. You can get a soil test to see what levels of nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus that you have in your soil. You can also start growing your plants and then look for symptoms that may indicate that they need the addition of some nutrients.
Mm-hmm. You know what? I have a habit of, whenever I look at a new soil, I will reach down and grab a handful of it, and I'll smell it, and which tells me something. I'm not sure exactly what, but I have a good sense. It kind of tells you, you know, the general health of it, and then you kind of rub it in your hands and you see if it holds itself together or if it crumbles and falls all apart. It's a good way to start getting started. Just get your hands in the soil. And then for the nutrient profiles, you could probably get a pretty good idea just by looking at other plants that are growing. Are they healthy or not? If they're not so healthy, maybe then you're deficient in something. But I always like feeding the soil and letting the soil feed the plants. I think it's, especially if it's your garden in your land, and that way, you know, you'll have good, healthy plants there. But it sometimes works. Well, there is organic fertilizer and there's synthetic fertilizer, and there's two ways of approaching it. Water is so precious here in California, but probably elsewhere around the world. How can we learn to be water-wise gardeners?
Ooh, I love this question. So the amount of water you apply on the plants of your landscape can depend on that plant's exposure to sun. It can depend on the soil type that your plant is planted in. And then it can also depend on the variety of plant that you've planted. So there are a lot of different components for understanding and dialing in just the right amount of water for your landscape. Now, I'm a really big proponent of what I call the deep and infrequent watering. So instead of applying just a little bit of water, maybe every day or every couple of days to my landscape, what I want to do is give my landscape, my plants, enough water. I do it through drip irrigation, that the entire root ball can be saturated with water. I do that very infrequently. In the springtime, I water once a month. In the summer, I water once every 2 weeks. In the fall, I go back to once a month. And then in the wintertime, I cut off my irrigation, as do most Californians, because we are dealing with our seasonal rainfall then.
Mm-hmm. And by watering infrequently, you encourage the plant's roots to go down deeper and deeper and deeper as well.
Absolutely.
Go get the water yourselves. And don't rely on me, and you'll be much better off. The other thing that's so important about watering is good soil will hold moisture and cut back on water use significantly. And that's why if you have some humus in the soil, you can do much better on the watering as well. And then, so we come to the fall when there's all of this produce to harvest. And we have a yard full of zucchini. What do we do with it all?
That's a great question.
well, it know, takes us back to, you know, what we want to plant, right? And how many we want to plant. And it seems like in the fall, there's a huge abundance of zucchini to be had when everybody in the neighborhood is trying to give theirs away.
There is. And, you know, what I think is important, once I've kind of saturated the market in terms of my neighbors with the sharing of zucchinis and other abundant produce, it's great to know how you can store that produce effectively. So, and there are recommendations that are available through Extension Master Gardener programs or other programs about whether or not you can freeze produce and how best to do that. Sometimes you have to blanch produce before it's frozen in order to really maintain some integrity after it's been frozen, once you defrost it and use it. So there are different techniques for freezing produce. Some items can also be dehydrated. And then there, of course, is canning, water bath canning and pressure canning. If you can't manage to cook everything in time before that produce.
Now, you mentioned the fact that you did a lot of canning. What did you can?
Ooh, I love canning. Food preservation is such a fun activity. I'm a real big fan of pickles, but non-traditional pickles. So watermelon rind pickles and pickled carrots, pickled beans, pickled asparagus, pickled onions. These are just, it's a neat way to consume different produce with a very different, sometimes texture.
And very good for the tummy too, right?
Exactly, yes.
Huh. One of my favorite photographs is that of my grandmother in her root cellar. And the entire wall is covered with mason jars containing different colors of foods. It's just a spectacular photograph. I look at that and think, yeah, they could make it through the winter. Pretty good shape with that kind of root cellar, I guess. But food preservation is something we don't think much of being city folks, because there's always fresh fruit, fresh food at the supermarket. But, you know, that's one thing that the COVID crisis has really brought to our attention, is the fact that what seems to be very certain can become very uncertain in a very short period of time. And so one of the things I wanted to ask you about is the trend toward gardening for food now. I understand that a lot of people are looking for what to do. Do you see that?
We are seeing that nationally, that people are consuming information about how to start growing fruits and vegetables in their home landscape.
Okay, the question was, what can people do to learn more about gardening for themselves in the face of this incredible pandemic panic? We all want to know that there is hope for food in the future, and one of the best ways of doing it is planting some of your own. First of all, are you seeing an increased awareness in this need for gardening food, Missy?
Yes, nationally we're seeing a really exciting trend where people are consuming information about food gardening just in an incredible way. There's this resurgence of interest. And if you look online, it won't be long before you start seeing the concept of victory gardens coming back around, that this is a way that people can take control of their food system in some way by planting edible plants in their home landscape.
And I guess the concept of a victory garden is always applicable, but in times of that are very tough, such as the ones we are going through right now, the concept of victory gardens is really important, because they do give you hope that somehow we can grow our way out of this rather than sitting there and huddling in our splendid isolation. We can be out in the garden taking care of ourselves. So, getting back to this notion of gardening as being essential, how do you think, as the mistress of master gardening, how on earth did we come to this notion that gardening would be so non-essential that we could close the garden shops?
You know, that's an interesting question, Michael, and I do know that it is very location-specific. In some places, garden centers are open because they're considered part of the agricultural services and the agricultural economic chain that we have. And so in some places, our garden centers are open, but with a very different model, where people are purchasing plants online and then picking up, where plants in some cases are bought to people's cars. In other cases, they have a designated pickup window where they can go and retrieve the purchase that they've already made. But the majority of the interaction is taking place online. So, I mean, you're right. In almost all cases, we are no longer able to go and peruse plants at our leisure.
Which was always the joy. And you talked about finding the right plant for you. You look at all the plants and it's like adopting a puppy.
I agree with that. I certainly find immense joy in taking some time for myself, whether or not I need plants, to go to the nursery and just look around. And I do look forward to the day that we come back to that. I'm trying to maintain that hope. Like you said, it's our purpose right now is to grow hope in the fact that there will be a better situation in the future. And so I look forward to that day that I'm back in the nursery. In the meantime, I have been trusting other people to make plant selections on my behalf, understanding that we have a common goal, that they'd like to sell me a plant that is going to thrive in my landscape. And I would like to purchase a plant that is going to be productive, and contribute back to my family, and my mental and physical health.
And in that, there is a lot of hope. Missy Gable, Director, UC Master Gardener Program, thank you so much for joining us. And folks, remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. Thank you, Missy, and thank you all for tuning in.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.